Could mixing and matching COVID-19 vaccines help get our economies back on track faster? Live from London, this is the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Victoria Craig. Good morning. Bumpy vaccine rollouts around the world have raised questions about how soon we can all return to life as we once knew it. Well, a study here in Britain is looking at ways to alleviate some of the stress. The key question researchers are asking now is whether using different coronavirus vaccines for a person's first and second doses helps our bodies mount better defenses against the virus. Researchers will start by giving 820 volunteers all over the age of 50, a mix of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine and the one made by Pfizer and BioNTech. The BBC's Dominic Hughes told me this is a strategy that has been deployed before with positive results.
It might sound like quite an alarming idea, but actually it's much more common than you would think. So, for example, in a lot of the vaccines and immunizations that are offered to children, they are often a mixed dose. And the idea of mixing vaccine doses is to offer the body more chances to develop defences against whatever virus is being targeted. This is, for example, exactly the process that was used in the fight against Ebola.
Now, we've seen a lot of tense back and forth about where various nations are in the priority lists for receiving vaccine doses. Could mixing and matching sort of alleviate some of the supply constraints?
Yeah, that's exactly one of the aims of this study, because introducing flexibility in the vaccination program could really help if there are problems with the supply. So if you have, for example, a hold up with your Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, you can offer the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine instead. And also, of course, it's going to be a huge benefit to those developing countries that have yet to get vaccination programs up and running. It really offers them a lot more flexibility.
Now, this news today also comes as a few countries, France, Germany, Italy, Sweden, Poland, they've all warned about concerns over the effectiveness of AstraZeneca's vaccine on older populations. And Switzerland today rejected approval for the vaccine, full stop. Could mixing and matching maybe soothe some of those concerns even?
Yeah, that's possible. I mean, it's certainly one of the things that the scientists are going to monitor. They're going to be looking at side effects. They're going to be keeping a close eye on blood tests to see how well the volunteers' immune systems respond. The study is also going to provide data on the impact of the vaccines on new variants and the effects of second doses at 4 and 12 weeks. So that sort of takes into account some of the effect on older groups as well. I think there is a lot of politics around the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, particularly with those EU countries where there have been questions over the supply and, you know, the back and forth over who gets what vaccine when. And also some caution about the results of the clinical trials that were carried out for Oxford AstraZeneca, because when they did those trials, they didn't have very many older people in that trial. But evidence, we're told by the company, is going to emerge in the coming weeks as more older people have been given the vaccine here in the UK.
The BBC's Dominic Hughes, thanks for breaking this down for us.
Not a problem.
Checking the numbers now, as that vaccine study gets underway here in the UK, shares of AstraZeneca are up more than 1.7% here in London this morning. But the company's performance is an outlier. More broadly, key European benchmarks are little changed. Deutsche Bank shares are down 1.4%. That's despite Germany's largest lender reporting a net profit for the first time in 6 years, helped by a surge in bond trading last year. And shares of Royal Dutch Shell are down 1.1% after the company said 2020 profits hit a 15-year low due to a drop in demand from the pandemic. If you build it, they will come. Turns out, if you offer it, they will also buy it. In the case of Australian wine, sales to the UK have surged nearly 30% in the last year. That's because producers who have been effectively locked out of the Chinese market thanks to crippling taxes on exports are searching for new places to sell their goods. The BBC's Justin Harper explains that shift could become a more permanent one.
You could say it was a bumper year, really, for wine in the UK, due to a number of factors, lockdown being one, with people consuming a lot more, and also the uncertainties over Brexit, with worries about wine from Europe as well.
And this all really goes back to an ongoing and simmering trade row between China and Australia, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right. It sort of started off as a political spat that got heightened over the coronavirus. And then, yeah, it spilled over into trade, and they are quite important trade partners. And yeah, wines were sort of like the latest product to be hit.
Does it look like they'll resolve this row anytime soon? Or do you think this could be potentially a more permanent shift, not just for wine, but other goods going from Australia to other places?
Yeah, I think with the pickup in sales in the UK and Europe, while volume-wise it's done well, they're still down on sales and revenue because China bought a lot more expensive wine.
And indeed, we've heard from Australian winemakers themselves that this spat has forced them to sort of take a harder look at their business. At the end of last year, Rod Hill at Cirame Wines told us the fresh round of 212% tariffs on his product caused him to rethink his business model.
Obviously, when certain channels become more difficult to operate in, you look at other channels that the barrier to entry might be less, like the USA, like Japan and Europe.
So, Justin, strategies like that seem to be working.
Yeah, they are sort of pivoting more to other countries, Australia. And at the same time, China had also been reducing the amount of wine it took from Australia because of this dual circulation concept where they wanted more locally produced products. And wine, obviously, they're starting to make a lot more, and the Chinese like that wine. So it could be a permanent shift.
And you mentioned Brexit. So do you think this shift for more Australian wines consumed in the UK could be a permanent one, because Brexit has made tariffs on wines coming in from EU countries like France more expensive here?
I think there's still a lot of uncertainty of how much, if at all, the price of European wines will go up when they're imported. The Brits have already loved Australian Chardonnays and Sauvignon Blancs, but it's been heightened by the fact that Australia has been targeting Europe and the UK for its wine.
The BBC's Justin Harper. Thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
And in case you're wondering, the most popular varieties among British consumers, Syrah, Chardonnay, and Cabernet Sauvignon. In London, I'm Victoria Craig with the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.